Earlier this year, I went on an order retreat to Bodhgaya in India, the place where the Buddha got enlightened. And as a part of that trip, I decided to spend a few days in Patna. And when I mentioned this to some people who knew Patna, they typically said to me things like, "Why on earth do you want to go and visit Patna?" This is Patna. So that was typical hurly-burly of an Indian city, I suppose. That was the view outside my hotel. So why would you want to go to visit Patna? Well, actually, there's quite a lot in Patna for the Buddhist, and particularly a lot for somebody who's interested in Ashoka, and or the Emperor Ashoka, or Ashoka the Great, as he's sometimes known. And Ashoka is indeed one of my heroes. So hence I wanted to visit Patna. And of course, my theme for this year is Heroes of the Dharma. And for this mini-series, starting this week, we're going to be looking at Disciples of the Buddha. So next week, Divan is going to be talking about some of the colourful characters who came to, who approached the Buddha for teachings. And following that, Vimalabhadri is going to be talking about the Teras, female disciples of the Buddha. But this week, it's Ashoka. So who was Ashoka? So Ashoka was... H.G. Wells, in his book, The Outline of History, said that amongst all the hundreds of majesties and highnesses and serenities and so on, the name of Ashoka shines like a bright star. And it wasn't just because he ruled and administered an enormous empire. He achieved many unique things that were way ahead of his time. But also his influence on Buddhism was enormous. So why is it then that he became almost completely forgotten in his home country of India, like the Dharma itself? What happened to Ashoka and the story of Ashoka? So what I'd like to do this evening is say something about how Ashoka was rediscovered, and then say something about the Ashoka story, to tell the Ashoka story, and then look and conclude with Ashoka's legacy. So let's begin by going to early 19th century India. So it's the time of the British Raj, and there's not a great deal known about ancient Indian history. You have this marvellous country with all these great monuments, buildings and so on, and there's not a great deal known about the ancient history. But there are a number of mysteries. So, for example, there are these rock edicts. So that's to say this script, this writing that's been carved, painstakingly carved into various places across India that are being discovered, more and more of them being discovered. And even more intriguing are these enormous columns or pillars. So let's have a quick look at them. So here we have an example of one of these enormous pillars. So 19 of these have been found. They're up to 15 metres high and weigh up to 50 tonnes. And they're capped by this impressive capital, as it's called at the top. So typically with an animal, typically a lion, actually. So quite magnificent pillars there. And this is an even better example of one of these lion capitals. This one was actually found at Sarnath, where the Buddha first taught. And you can see an absolutely wonderful carving, and the finish as well, you know, the way it's polished. How would you go about creating something like that, even today, let alone with rudimentary tools and so on? And these two were, these columns also had carving on them. This is an example of that script, the same script that was found on the edicts and the columns. And it's now, these days it's known as Brahmi. But it was undeciphered at the time. So what is it that these people were trying to say. Who were these people who were putting these scripts here, erecting these columns, and what was it they were trying to say to us? So nobody knew. The locals at the time thought that it was probably the work of gods or giants. Some of them were considered to be giants' walking sticks, for example. But many British officers took an interest in some of these mysteries, and in their free time set about exploring and trying to figure out what they meant. And it took on more of an official tone, and the British authorities funded research and set up departments and stuff to look into all this history. And there were lots of people who were quite heroic in uncovering many of the mysteries of ancient India. But I'm only going to mention one, and that's James Prinsep. And James Prinsep arrived in India in the as a young man of in his early 20s, and he worked in the mint. So quite naturally, this led to an interest in some of the ancient coins that were being that were turning up, being discovered all over India. And this in turn led to an interest in what was written on the coins, so in scripts and ancient languages and so on. And to cut a very long story short, James Prinsep figured out what this said. He was able to decipher it and realise what it said. It was written, it was a script that was of the language of Magadhi, or one of the Prakrit languages of northern India, which are, or a dialect of it. Similarly, the Buddha also spoke one of a dialect of this group of languages. So what did it say? Well, they all talked about, they all said that they were put there by somebody who named himself Beloved of the Gods, King Piyadasi. Beloved of the Gods, King Piyadasi. But nobody knew who he was or where he came from. But James Prinsep figured it out. And there are two ways that he did this. First of all, not long before these were put there, a few decades before, Alexander the Great had invaded India. And as often happens when a great emperor dies, then he leaves a great vacuum. And so it was when Alexander the Great died young. His empire, or the conquered lands, collapsed into a series of states, which were typically ruled over by his generals. Now we know quite accurately the names and the dates of these rulers of these states. Unfortunately, many of these edicts and comments mentioned surrounding rulers. So it was quite useful in being able to date them. Also, there were two sources for this Emperor Ashoka from the Mahayana tradition and from the Theravada tradition. And they seemed very legendary. They weren't, some of the details of the story were the same, but some of them were different. And it seemed to be very much this a sort of mythic ideal ruler. But Prinsep realised that King Piyadasi was in fact Ashoka. Ashoka wasn't just a legend or a myth, he really did exist, and he put up these columns and these rock edicts. So what we know now is that Ashoka was born in round about 304 BCE, so 300 years before Jesus, which is about 100 or 180 years after the death of the Buddha. So it's interesting that we know the dates for Ashoka quite accurately, but there's still some dispute about the dates for the Buddha. Although these days it seems that the most commonly held theory is that he died in about 400 BCE. So Ashoka was born probably about 100 years after the Buddha. And he was given the name Ashoka, as Ashoka means without sorrow. And his mother said when he was born that I am now without sorrow. So he was given the name Ashoka. Now, in the time of the Buddha, you may be aware that there were a number of states. In particular, I'm thinking of Magadha, which was ruled by, earlier in the Buddha's life, it was ruled by... It was ruled by King Bimbisara. Who featured in the Pali text quite a lot. And it was a tough life being a king in those days, as it was quite often in history. And the upshot was the crown prince got bored with being a crown prince and impatient, and he didn't want to directly harm his father, so he locked him up in a prison and starved him to death. And he then embarked on a program of expansion, so he attacked the neighboring states, absorbed them, and so on. And over the course of the next 100 years, there was various evolution of this state of Magadha, various dynastic changes, and it evolved into the Mauryan Empire. And it was this Mauryan Empire into which Ashoka was born. And in fact, he was born as the son of the emperor. But he wasn't first in line to the throne. He wasn't second in line to the throne. In fact, he was 100th in line to the throne. So he had a bit of work to do if he wanted to end up being ruler. And as you can gather, the emperors and kings in those days had quite a lot of wives. So there he was, 100th in line to the throne. Not only that, but he wasn't very popular with his father. The king didn't like him much, apparently. He wasn't a great physical specimen, from what we know. He also had certain ailments. We're pretty sure he had some sort of skin complaint. And he would seem to be prone to fainting and possibly even seizures. So anyway, his father didn't like him much. When he became a young man, his father, there was a rebellion in one province of the empire, and so his father shipped him off to try and sort out this problem. Now, he already had quite a reputation by this point as being a fierce, brutal, ruthless warrior. And he managed to sort out the conflict without any bloodshed. Whether this was due to his reputation or due to his negotiating skills, we don't really know, but he seemed to do quite a good job. Later on, his father sent him off to another part of the empire as governor. Here he met the love of his life, Devi, who became his first wife. And we believe that she was a Buddhist, and she was a relatively lowly status, but it does seem that they genuinely loved one another. She gave him his first two children, his son Mahendra and his daughter Sangamitta. Back at the capital city, Pataliputra, which is present-day Patna, of course, there was another rebellion in another part of the country, and his father wanted to send him off again to sort it out. But he thought he'd play a trick on his father, and he seemed to have some support by some of the senior ministers and advisors of the king. It seems that the crown prince, the heir to the throne, wasn't popular. He was a very arrogant person. He publicly humiliated some of the chief ministers, so they didn't like him. So they worked with Ashoka to trick the king. So what they did was, you could remember this if you're on a day off work, perhaps. What they did was Ashoka covered himself in turmeric and then went to his father and said, "I'd love to go and sort out the rebellion, but I'm really, as you can see, I'm not feeling well. My skin's playing up again." So, So the king sent the crown prince off instead. When the crown prince was out of the picture, Ashoka went back to see the king, presumably having washed off all the turmeric, and demanded to be made regent. And the king was so shocked by this and upset, he apparently had an apoplectic fit and died. So, this left Ashoka with the capital in his hands, capital city. So naturally, the crown prince wasn't very happy about this, stormed back to Pataliputra to try and sort it out. So these ministers and Ashoka played a trick on the crown prince, a very cunning trick. They made a model Ashoka, put the model Ashoka on a model elephant, put the model elephant in a big pit of flaming coals. And then they goaded the crown prince. They sort of said, if you want to be the emperor, then you've just got to take out Ashoka. There he is. Go and get him. Go and get him. So the crown prince rushed off to attack the model Ashoka, fell into the pit of coals, and burned to death. But of course, this wasn't the end of the story, because there were another 98 half-brothers who also wanted to be king, or might have wanted to be king. So he had to deal with those as well. So there was 4 years of warfare while he basically killed all these half-brothers of his. and he dumped all the bodies in a well. This well, as a matter of fact, this is Ashoka's well in Patna, and even today, people, strangely enough, won't drink from the well. It's said to be the bottomless well. It isn't actually bottomless, obviously, but it's quite deep. And so Ashoka was said to have thrown all his half-brothers into the well. Behind the well was Ashoka's hell, which was his torture chamber. And for a laugh, Ashoka decorated the front of the torture chamber beautifully, like it was a beautiful building. So on the outside, it was Ashoka's heaven, and on the inside, it was Ashoka's hell. So you had that sense of humour there. And it's said when if you went into Ashoka's hell, you would never come out alive. So he was a bit of a brutal chap. On another occasion, he overheard some of his wives, because he had a number of wives by this time, some of his wives saying how they didn't like to touch him because of his skin problems, and so he had them killed. So there we have Ashoka's well. So he was now emperor. After 8 years of his reign, he decided to launch a war against the Kalingas to expand his empire. And it was a brutal affair. 100,000 Kalingan soldiers are said to have died, and 150,000 Kalingans were displaced, many of whom also died. At the end of the war, which Ashoka won, he went to visit his new lands. And his empire had expanded quite a bit by this time. So you can see he ruled a vast empire. There's his capital, Pataliputra, Patna nowadays. So aside from this southern bit, this the tip of India, he ruled all of present-day India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, much of Afghanistan, Bangladesh, and seeping into other countries as well. So an enormous empire. Imagine what it would have taken to go from one side to the other in those days. It took weeks and weeks. Anyway, the Kalingans lived about here, so he absorbed the Kalingans as well. But rather than feeling joy and pride in his conquest, when he saw the carnage of the battlefield and he looked into the faces of the refugees, he actually felt great remorse. A woman came up to him and said, "You've taken away my father, you've taken away my husband, you've taken away my son. There is nothing for me." He realized that this conquest by force of arms caused an enormous amount of suffering. And there and then he undertook never to use force of arms for conquest again. Instead, he would conquer by the Buddha's Dharma. He had an epiphany and became confirmed Buddhist at that point in time. And a genuine Buddhist. He really tried then from that point on to behave in a way that the Buddha would have approved. So that was 8 years into his reign. After 10 years, he went on a grand pilgrimage and visited the important Buddhist sites of the day. And he was particularly taken by Bodhgaya, where the Buddha gained enlightenment, and particularly by the Bodhi tree, as we were just hearing about. He became devoted to the Bodhi tree. It was a symbol for all that he held of all his values, of all that he thought was great about the Buddha's Dharma and all the benefits that it could follow from it. So he was utterly devoted to the Bodhi tree. After 12 years, he started to place these rock edicts. And he placed them typically in prominent places overlooking population centres, so that his people could clearly see them. Here's a recreation of an actual rock edict of Ashoka's time. This is in the National Museum in Delhi. I'm sure Badri could probably read the script for it, but just in case, here it is in English. And I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but some of the points here are really quite extraordinary. Bear in mind, this is 2,300 years ago. So number one, no living being may be slaughtered for sacrifice. In and outside his domains, Priyadarshi Ashoka has arranged for the medical treatment of man and beast. he's arranged for the medical treatment of animals. And apparently he really did this. He created hospitals for people, but for animals as well. What extraordinary. He expects his descendants to likewise to continue to promote the Dharma. So he's trying to create a legacy here, not just himself, but for well into the future. Reports of affairs in his kingdom could be brought to his notice any time, as he considered it his duty constantly and speedily to attend to the welfare of his subjects. And again, apparently he was as good as his word. You could interrupt Ashoka when he was having a meal, when he was with his wives, when he was on the loo. You know, you could, he would care and he would come and try to help. He genuinely thought he was a servant of his people. And he also, another one here, which would be a good one to have these days, actually. Priyadarshi wishes that all religious sects in his dominion should live in peace and amity. Now, that would be good, wouldn't it, if we could manage that these days. He also mentions here that the conqueror of Kalinga resulted in unprecedented slaughter and carrying away of captives brought remorse to Priyadarshi. He was therefore determined to conquest through Dharma. So there he's kind of expressing his own remorse there for what he had done. So quite extraordinary, really. Unlike, you know, most kings and emperors and so on, trying to let everybody know how wonderful they are and how powerful they are, quite a different character to these Wakidas of Ashoka. Also, in about this time, he embarked on a policy of missionary work. So he sent missionaries off to many of the surrounding countries, far and wide, including his son and daughter, who had become a monk and a nun, who went to Sri Lanka and planted the seed of the Dharma in Sri Lanka, where it is carried on into this day. This was extremely important. When Buddhism died out, or more or less died out in India, partially because of Ashoka's missionary work, Buddhism had spread beyond the boundaries of India and was able to flourish and continue and develop in other countries. So incredibly important. In the 17th year of his reign, he organized the third Buddhist council. So like the first two Buddhist councils, they were primarily to try and ensure that we had an understanding of the Dharma, to clarify what the Dharma actually was, to make clear the Buddha's teaching. And so he built a huge pavilion with loads of stone columns. His spiritual teacher, Moggaliputta Tissa, oversaw the spiritual side of the affair, and the monks and nuns came from all over the country for this Buddhist council. And it was held here in what's now Parkland, a very nice park in Patna. Here you can see some students playing kibadi, and here you can see some remains of the columns from Ashoka's pavilion. He was a bit of a victim of his own success because he was so generous to the Sangha that it attracted a number of people who weren't really Buddhists but just wanted an easy life because they could get fed and sheltered and by becoming a monk or a nun and not have to do too much work. So part of the work of this Third Buddhist Council was sorting out who was really practicing and who wasn't. And it ended with quite a number of people being expelled from the Sangha. In the 26th year of his reign, he started on this work on these pillars that are now known as the Ashoka pillars, Ashokan pillars. So he erected them on typically around the perimeter of his empire, as well as at the main Buddhist pilgrimage points. But time was marching on, as it tends to do, and he was getting older. The love of his life, Devi, his first wife, unfortunately died. He came besotted by a concubine of his and made her his new wife. She wasn't such a nice person, it would appear. She was so jealous of Ashoka's love for the Bodhi tree that she tried to kill it. She tried to kill it with a poisoned thorn. According to some accounts, she succeeded in killing it, and Ashoka had to restore it from a cutting of the original tree. According to other accounts, she felt remorse on seeing what she'd done and restored it herself. Either way, Ashoka was completely very upset and shocked when he saw that the Bodhi tree had been attacked in this way. She was also involved in a plot which resulted in the crown prince being blinded. So it doesn't appear she was very a nice person, and in some accounts she ended up by being put to death. The ministers of Ashoka increasingly began to take power away from him because it was like he was becoming a bit of a problem. His generosity, for one thing, was a bit of a problem. He seemed to be keep giving everything away. And for a minister who's trying to run the country, you need funds. And, you know, they look round and the fun, oh dear, Ashoka's given all our money away again. So it was a bit of a problem. On one occasion, Ashoka apparently gave away the entire planet to the Buddhist Sangha. And so Ashoka's ministers had to buy back the entire planet from the Sangha for a large quantity of gold coins. So they tried to limit Ashoka's power as he grew older and more frail. By the time he got to his deathbed, the only thing he had to give away was half a fruit. And so he did indeed donate this to the Buddhist Sangha. They took it to the local Vihara, which is the wonderfully named Ashoka Rama, and made it into a soup for the monks. And at that point, he died. So he died at the age of 72, and he ruled the empire for 36 years. So what did he leave? What was his legacy? One of the most tangible things was that he left hundreds, probably thousands, of stupas and viharas all over his empire that he had funded. One of the most notable is the site at Sanji. Now, this was not directly associated with the Buddha, but it is a place of pilgrimage these days. It's believed that it was built by Ashoka for his wife, because it was built on the outskirts of the town from which she came. It's said that they got married there. It's got many wonderful carvings. Many of them were done after Ashoka, has to be said. But it's been extensively examined and investigated these days, and it provides very strong and powerful proof of the story of Ashoka. Also there is some of the remains of Moggallupta Tissa, his main spiritual teacher, as well as some of the principal disciples of the Buddha as well are interred at Sanji. The empire itself limped along for another 50 years or so, but as I mentioned, when a great emperor dies, often it leaves a great vacuum, and so this empire quickly got overtaken by surrounding states and empires and so on. But there are other things that he's left to us. You might know from the story of the Buddha, or the story of the death of the Buddha, that when the Buddha died, he was cremated on a funeral pyre, and there were eight parties that were interested in the remains. And so they divided up the remains into eight portions, gave each portion to the party, and each party took them away to their own land, their own homeland, and interred them underneath a stupa. Now, Ashoka was very keen on spreading the Buddha's relics as far and wide as possible, so as many people could benefit from them as possible. So he dug up seven of these eight stupas, and then maybe couldn't find the other one, I don't know, but he dug up seven of them, took out three quarters of the remains of the Buddha that they found there, and distributed it to stupas and viharas all over the country, and put back the remaining quarter and interred it once more. Now, one of these was it by Shaolin, and it's been extensively studied since. It was the stupa that the Lichilis put their portion of the remains of the Buddha in. And when it's been studied since, it was found there that there was a coin, a conch, some gold foil, and a bead, and what appears to be the remains of the Buddha. And here they are. The extensive archaeological and scientific study of these remains has corroborates the stories that we hear in the Pali Canon and about Ashoka himself. It does indeed seem that they were interred there at one point, 100 or 200 years afterward, they were disinterred, and some of the remains, three quarters of the remains, were taken away, and the rest was put back, just like it says in the various stories that have come down to us. All the evidence tells us that these are indeed, they genuinely are, the remains of the Buddha. So, you know, I'm not one for holy relics at all, but I do find that actually quite amazing. And you can see these, if you want, in the museum at Patna. They've put them underneath this recreation of the Vaishali stupa. It's not life-size, obviously. It's not. It's just more of a modest size. But you can go there and visit it. There's quite strict security, and you have to pay extra money and everything. But there, you can go and visit the remains for yourself. Ashoka really was a Chakravartin, I think, a wheel-turning monarch, a Dharma Raja, a righteous king. He tried to do many wonderful things, and I think as a result of his actions, has had an enormous beneficial effect on Buddhism. If you compare Buddhism with Jainism, for example, there were many similarities. They started in around about the same time, in around about the same place. At the time of Ashoka, they were both regional cults, and they're both so-called karmic religions. But whereas Jainism is still really a regional cult, Buddhism is a global religion. And a lot of that can be down to the way that Ashoka spread the Dharma, both in India and, more importantly perhaps, beyond the boundaries of India as well. For every one Jain, there are 100 supporters and followers of the Buddha. So he did some incredible things, ruled an incredible empire, which in itself is just an incredible administrative feat. But things didn't always work out for him as well. He tried to do his best, but sometimes things didn't go quite as well. The end of his reign really sort of ended in pathos, really. He had human failings. So do you want to see what he looks like? This is probably the best representation that we have of Ashoka. So, as you can see, he's not a great striving colossus, not an Apollo-type figure. Here, in fact, he's just seeing what his evil wife has done to the Bodhi tree, and he's fainting in shock and dismay, and he's having to be held up by some of his other wives. You can see he's not particularly tall. In fact, he's no taller than his wives that surround him. He's not a particularly imposing figure. He's got a bit of a paunch there. And, his head. One commentator said that he's got a head like a pumpkin. It's perhaps a bit unkind. But he doesn't seem to be a particularly handsome figure. But then that is Ashoka. This is probably the best representation we have in that it was carved not long after he died, and this is from Sanchi. So he was a great ruler. He did many great things, had an enormously beneficial effect, I believe, on Buddhism. But he had human failings as well. He was a tremendous man, and what I find so heroic about him is he did these wonderful things, but he did it in the face of the fact that he had ordinary limitations, and that sometimes he didn't get it right. He was an enormous figure, but at the same time, he was human. So, thank you for listening. And perhaps now we'll have some discussion about it.
Thank you.